Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Everything is a Spring. Derek, how are you, buddy?
Jim, I'm feeling good today. Good old-fashioned corporate work day behind me, a classic Monday-flavored Monday. But, you know, just turned 26 yesterday.
Heck yeah, okay. Happy birthday, man.
Oh, boy. So it's all downhill from here, huh?
Yep, all of your bone density has been established.
You know, my director at my job told me last year on my birthday, he's like, hey, 25, you know, that's the best year of your life. You know, make sure you really get after it. And at the end of the road at 26, where? Where? Man, it's been a challenge, but holy.
That's fair. I guess 25 was a pretty good year for me. But like, I hope it doesn't get like, I still think like there's a lot to be done and a lot to do and like a lot of good to be done and had. So
surely it must be better, right? Right?
One would think. I think so. I really think like even now, like I really feel like I'm just starting to hit my stride.
There you go.
You know, like I really feel like I'm starting to get my life together a little bit.
Oh, look at you, Mr. Fancy Pants, with his life together over here.
We're trying.
Board progress.
But, you know, I definitely think, like, you know, you can teach an old dog new tricks, even if that old dog is you. And so I'm still very hopeful for the future, even at, you know, about to be 27, which makes me feel very old.
Right. We're past the precipice. We're closer to 30. Oh, no.
I know. All our cells are starting to die off at a faster rate than they're being made, Derek.
My knees, Jim, my knees.
I can feel it in my hips.
Oh my gosh. No, I can't complain, man. Bumpy start, but you know, I got to see a couple of pals unexpectedly and mostly just sat on Discord and gamed for the rest of the night. But yeah, you know, I really can't complain. I am happy that I've made it another year around the rock, so to speak.
Heck yeah, man. Another trip around the sun.
Didn't fall off.
That would be very dramatic, right? Like,
wouldn't
if
it?
You, like if you tripped and then just fell off the earth.
Yeah, like we're spinning just a touch faster, so it's enough to take you.
He's like, "Wee!"
And he's gone.
And he's gone. It's like, well, that's gone forever, you know.
Anything good in your week, Jim?
I was kind of sick over the weekend, to be quite honest. So I just kind of laid low, and Saturday and Sunday I played like a lot of Baldur's Gate 3.
Heck yeah, man. It's an addicting game.
It's very good. And it's funny, right? Because I'm aware that it's addicting. And so my solution to that is just not to play it for very long stretches of time.
Oh, so it like evens out. I'm not playing it a little every day. I'm just playing it a lot once a week. And it just
exactly.
happens to be 7 hours, you know.
Exactly. So like I haven't played in like, before this weekend, I probably haven't played in like 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, it's been maybe not 4 weeks, but like probably 3 weeks.
I bet that's nice to come back to it though, because it's fresher. You know, you get a little break from it.
It kind of is. I mean, I'm definitely not like tired of the game. I am kind of like towards the end of it though. I don't want to spoil anything, but like the end of the game, there's some stuff that kind of like comes to a head where it's just like, dang, like this is really not what I expected, right? Like, I guess like, so I'm the kind of guy when I play a video game, cause like, I understand I'm going to play this one time.
Right.
So I'm very close to the end of the game, and I'm the kind of guy. So when I do play games like this, like these kind of RPG type games where, you know, your choices matter and everything, I actually feel like a lot of pressure to like, quote unquote, get it right.
Yeah.
You know? And so, like, now as we're approaching the end of the game, there's a character who I really wish I could save that I don't think I'm going to be able to just because of the decisions that I've made along the way. They're, like, now way too far in the back to go back and change and, like, replay or whatever. And, like, I don't want it to end, but also, like, there's nothing left really to do at this point. So it's just kind of like it needs to just happen. But anyway, so... but it's been very fun. I'm really enjoying it. So I'm sad that it's ending. I actually am like, I'm very sad about a few of the characters who I'm pretty sure are going to die. Cause they're just great characters. The voice acting in the game really is really, really well done.
I mean, a well-earned game of the year, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. Really a fantastic game. So, I'm also a huge nerd, so I'm biased, but
man, if you're on this podcast, you're a huge nerd. If you're listening to this podcast, I got bad news for you, listener.
The diagnosis is in.
Yeah.
You're a nerd.
Hey, I don't make the rules, you know?
I just live by them.
Mm-hmm, and barely.
Don't hate the play, I hate the game.
Exactly. Hate the game, but not Baldur's Gate 3, game of the year.
That was a good game.
Right on.
So, anyway, so that was kind of my weekend. So very, very easygoing, but good.
Yeah, I was trying to go. Well, I'll brief aside, right? So my birthday is around Valentine's Day. So every year, you know, it's like Valentine's Day takes away from anybody's birthday who's like beginning of February. This year, it was especially difficult, right? Because like all I had time to do is like, I'll go with a couple friends, maybe hit one of our bars. And just, you know, have a couple drinks and relax, right? That didn't happen. I thought, you know, every bar that I went to that wasn't a sports bar was closed. Rightfully so, you know, give the workers a break so they can watch the game. But we went to three separate, like...
Oh, I forgot about the Super Bowl.
Yeah, the Super Bowl happened, and apparently Taylor Swift won, so all is right in the world. Yeah. You should have seen it. She threw like an 87-yard reception. It was crazy.
Taylor Swift won the Super Bowl?
No, I'm just memeing. You know, like the stuff with Travis Kelce, like they're dating. So it's the Taylor Bowl, really.
Ah.
I have to give them credit, like the NFL broadcasting team. All of the Chiefs games up to this point, you know, it has been Taylor Cam, like constantly. But they really like kind of dialed it back. You know, they cut to her a few times, but they added like other folks. It felt really balanced. So, like, you know, the good. Swifties got their in, the folks that like sports got their in, and the folks that just like celebrities, you know, they kind of balanced it out, I think, really well. And then, you know, at the trophy presentation, you know, it was all Taylor time after that, you know?
Oh, geez. So I just looked it up real quick. Apparently, this guy, you know, they finished the game or whatever, and this guy who... is oh, what a sweetheart. He kisses and embraces his mom and then he goes to Taylor Swift and he says, "Come here, girl." It's just like, oh, come here, girl. What a Chad,
dude. And think about it, you just won the Super Bowl, you're dating Taylor Swift. Honestly, at that moment, that's probably peak, right? Like, it that's doesn't probably get any better good. Than that,
you know. If he's 25,
that's
he's peaked.
There you go. If you're 25 and you're dating Taylor, I know Travis Kelce isn't 25, but let's just say hypothetically that'd be the best year of his life. And it seems so wholesome. Like, I don't really submit to the whole like parasocial relationships with celebrities and stuff. Like, I have artists that I absolutely love, but it's important to separate, you know, the music or the art from the person. Oh, cause like, I don't know that person. They could be the best or worst person in the world. We'd never know it. Right.
That's very true.
And I think a lot
Keanu
of
Keanu Reeves.
Except for Keanu Reeves, yeah. He might just be the best of us all. I'd love to watch. I would pay to be in a like one of his movies that are action-based if I could just get murdered viciously on screen. Like, even if it's just for like 4 seconds, you're the guy that gets kicked off the roof or something.
Oh, that'd be fun. I actually think that'd be a great time.
Wouldn't it?
like if you're professionally that random extra who dies immediately in film, I think that'd be hilarious.
Because, you know, you get to meet the crew, you know, you're on set for that day of shooting, you know. It just seems like that is one character where every television appearance I see of him, I'm more impressed. Like, you learn more about the guy. He's a huge motorhead, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty much owns his own motorcycle company now, right? And several others.
Who, Travis Taylor?
No, Keanu.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Dango Keanu. Did you say Travis Taylor? I think that's what the really people confused. Want.
I got really confused. What's his name? I don't even know.
Travis Kelce.
There you go.
Yeah. Like, it's interesting. Something this happened. Is the weirdest trajectory for a football player. Of course, folks are going to know his name now because of the Super Bowl win. Absolutely. but folks that aren't even interested in football know his name and are probably pseudo stalking him just to make sure that he's like treating her right, which is
make
impossible
sure you're
to know.
Good for Taylor Swift.
Wouldn't that be terrifying? You have hundreds of millions of fans everywhere you go for the rest of your life. You're a professional football player, and they're never going to see you as that.
You'd better treat Taylor Swift right, or we're going to, you know, like right. throw a lipstick at your car or whatever.
You know, I'm thinking, I'm looking forward to the Swiftie Crusades of 2026. You know, I think she has a standing army. All they have to do is train. I think 2 years out, they could actually, you know, like, they could coup a small country easily.
I think it's a fair point. Are we talking about Taylor Swift 2028?
You know, she's not old enough, right?
Oh, is she not?
At the moment? Yeah, I think you have to be, what, 30? I should know this is my country. 35? Oh, gosh. So I got to wait another 10 years before I can take over the world?
That's right.
Rubbish.
Well, before so Taylor Swift's 34.
34? Okay, so she can't do this election, but we got her next
election. But 2028.
You know, what's sad? Of the options we have today, yeah, I'd choose Taylor if it was on the board. I'm hoping we get surprise Michelle Obama. I know she's probably not going to want to do that because she already spent 8 years in politics.
Oh, no, I'd be so far out of it.
But yeah, just to sway swiftly away from politics. This is an engineering podcast, Jim.
It is. That's true.
So I've been told.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
Even the Swifties are springs.
Let's not get too far into that one. That could be a dangerous rabbit hole.
You don't mess with the Swifties, Jim.
You don't mess with the Swifties.
We know better.
We know better. You know, we'll mess with big podcasts,
all day.
Big pharma, all day, every day.
Big Dow?
I ain't fucking with the Swifties.
Uh-uh. I'm more afraid of the Swifties than Dow Chemical by a margin.
That's rule number one.
Yeah. You don't mess with their turf.
You don't mess... Well, because it's very dangerous to mock religions, Derek.
Oh, you know, it is... pseudo-religious at this point.
It's a like, little bit of a cult.
Like. I won't call it a cult, you know, like there hasn't been any like sacrifices yet, but you know, the Swiftie Crusades of 26, we're all prepared. We all know we have the script. So like when Taylor comes to power, you know, submit to your overlords, hide your kids.
Here's all I'm saying, right? Like she looks really good for 35.
She looks really good in general, you know?
That's facts.
She's a good-looking lady.
You know, a little bit of ritual sacrifice goes a long way to keep the body youthful.
Oh, so maybe she's like 135. We just
I think that's probably actually the truth. I think she was probably born in like the 1800s.
I wouldn't be
because
if she's a vampire,
how else could
sense?
You have exactly
wouldn't
right?
It make
maybe
sense?
Taylor Swift is a vampire. That's my new theory.
Yeah. Okay, I like this. So at the Swiftie Crusades 26, Swifties disregard that part. We don't know nothing.
Yeah, we have to cut that last few minutes or we're going to get killed by the Swiftie vampires.
Well, because that's what's interesting. I've never seen a celebrity amass a following, not so quickly, because she's been an artist for the better part of 10, 15 years.
Oh, yeah.
But her popularity the last three has, I mean, it's getting to a legendary status, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think part of it is like, I think she is actually a very good artist.
Yeah.
Right?
Excellent entrepreneur, too. Like, the way that she has... Did you know that the Swifties have black markets for her merch at this point?
Really?
Yeah. Like, it's that deep. You could buy... Allegedly. You could buy, like, a snow globe that she made it like when she was writing country music or something. And people will flip it for thousands of dollars. Like, they'll pay $1,000 for a record that's not even... I mean, maybe it's signed, but... There's a supply and demand to the point of having an underground Swiftie merch market, which I'm thinking we should get in on while the going's hot, you know? Anyone's a genius, what you do is you just you hire a professional counterfeiter.
Buy low, sell high.
Exactly. Buy a professional counterfeiter, saturate the market to the point where we come up as a verified Swiftie, you know, artisanal verifiers, right? We can look at the Swiftie merch and tell you if it's real or not, but in reality, it's our merch on the market,
too. It's all our merch.
It's like, why is there everything's a Spring logo on this Red album? What the hell?
Oh my gosh. That's how you really get ahead in life, guys. That's is fraud.
Corporate fraud.
That's the real way to get it. If I've learned anything from being in business, it's that the only way to get ahead in this life is fraud.
We at Whiskey Grill and Everything's a Spring Incorporated do not suggest that you try fraud, and we have not done it ourselves. This is a legal statement.
For legal reasons, I have to say that I do not approve of fraudulent banking.
Fraud? Nah, not for me. Not in my good Christian household.
Not in my Christian Minecraft server.
Mm-mm. Well, but anyway.
Swiftly moving along.
Swifty moving along?
Hey!
All right, that's the last y'all get. I've catered to them.
Swifty moving along. Derek, what do you know? I think we've talked a little bit about this, right? So you've been out west before, right?
I have been out west.
Have you ever been out to L.A.?
You know what? I've never been in L.A. Only the airport. Like, I've passed through the airport once or twice, but I've never explored it.
Good stuff. I like it. So just to the north of San Francisco is the San Francisquito Canyon.
I'm not making that up.
Thank you. Yes, it is. I'm not making that up. It is called the San Francisquito Canyon.
That sounds like something I made up.
It is. It's a little bit. Excuse me.
We got an over-under on if Jim survives to the end of this episode.
This is facts. We may have to cut it early. We'll see. I'm going to try to make it, though. We're 20 minutes in. We're a third of the way through.
There you go.
Anyway, the less I have to say Francisquito, the better it will be for my life.
I could practice that all day, and I'm still going to mess it up. San Francisquito?
It's San Francisquito.
That's too many syllables. Get a life.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Get after it. It's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot. So, but anyway, it's located north of the Los Angeles County, the city center of Los Angeles County. And it is the home, or it was the home, I should say, because it is in fact no longer the home, of the St. Francis or San Francisquito.
It's going to be that all episode.
I think this is the last time I have to say it, because I'm just going to refer to it as the St. Francis Dam at this point. But it was also called the San Francisquito Dam. But anyway, it was a concrete arched gravity dam built between 1924 and 1926.
Okay.
And it failed catastrophically.
Okay.
In 1928. Killing 431 people in the subsequent flood, destroying nearly $7 million of property in 1928, which, you know, is a lot more in today's money, and is widely regarded as the largest civil engineering disaster in the 20th century.
So, the inevitable, like, wave of water after the failure, is that why they called it the Roaring Twenties? Hey! Tasteless jokes.
Yeah, it's all good. Well, it certainly did bring a different kind of roar to the 20s. But anyway, so let me set the stage for you, like why this is all happening. So this is the 1920s, and Los Angeles is a growing, booming town. I mean, so in 1900, there was less than 100,000 people who lived in Los Angeles.
Oh, right? Cool.
By 1910, I believe it is, there were 300,000 people who were living in Los Angeles. They tripled it in 10 years.
Wow.
By 1930, or I think it's 1920, there's 500,000 plus people living in Los Angeles.
That's exponential.
Right, so the city is growing at an absolutely enormous rate. And one of the problems with that is that there is such a huge demand for water. People use a lot of water. So there had been like 7 different dam structures that were built nearby to basically, as it was growing, to continue providing more and more water, basically. And so this is the kind of the next iteration of that. Was like they were basically said, we need a bigger dam. We need a bigger water reservoir to feed this growing city.
We must construct additional dam.
They had to construct additional pylons. They did, absolutely. And so basically they get a guy by the name of Mulholland is his name.
Mulholland.
Mulholland. What's his first name? William Mulholland.
It's a pretty good name.
He is, at that point, he had been basically doing like a lot of earthen embankment dams. And he had done one at the point of this dam's construction. He had done one other concrete arch, gravity arch dam, which basically was identical initially to this one, which was named after him. It was called the Mulholland Dam.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And the reason, one of the reasons he's selected for this project is he's actually been, Mulholland has been involved with kind of the water infrastructure of Los Angeles for like almost 15, 20 years at this point. And his kind of claim to fame at that point was that he had designed and supervised the construction of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, which at that point in time was the longest aqueduct in the world. And it brought used gravity alone to bring water 233 miles from the Owens Valley to Los Angeles, and operates to this day in very good working order. Although it was sabotaged a couple times.
Wait, really?
And we'll get into that. Yeah, that's actually part of this story.
They poisoned the water supply, burned our crops, and brought a plague into our houses.
Yeah. So, like, the part of the thing is like, so the water issue for this. Is because this is a fairly arid climate, naturally. And as we know from pretty modern history, it's very prone to droughts, right? Lake Mead, which is the Hoover Dam, right, is still significantly down from its levels where it should be. And there's, you know, they've been looking at doing potential water rationing and stuff like that. But anyways, so dams are becoming more and more important in the 1920s because they're not only a source of water, but also a source of electricity for hydropower. And so basically they're looking at the San Francisco Canyon as a potential dam site. And in 1911, there had been a like a survey of the area. And basically they found that, well, okay, so geologically, there's a very interesting thing about the San Francisco Canyon.
All right.
And that it is that it is on a fault line.
Oh.
And so and it's inactive, right? So that's not going to be like, you know, the dam's just going to break in half because of an earthquake. What is significant about that is that basically one side of the dam, the left-hand side, the east side of the dam, is basically on like solid bedrock.
That's good.
And
right?
Then that's very good. The west side of the dam, however, is on what's called at the time red conglomerate.
Red conglomerate.
It is not nearly as good as basically it's schist is the other material that the other rock is made out of. But we're not a geology podcast, so we're not going to get into that too much.
Not yet.
But even schist is a spring.
But
in 1911, they basically say, all right, well, this is still like, you know, it's going to be okay. If we wanted to build a dam here, we could. Because they've been looking at this for a while, basically. None of these infrastructure projects happen overnight. But yeah, so the western hillside that the dam is eventually built onto, is predominantly reddish-colored conglomerate and sandstone with small veins of gypsum. And then the rest of the hillside and the floor and eastern wall is much harder, which is mica schist and talc.
Dude, some rock lover fan just got really excited.
But basically, they perform like a bunch of different geological tests on the material to try to make sure that it was going to be satisfactory for the construction of a dam. Because one of the concerns about constructing a dam is what is it sitting on, right? Because if you put all this water, basically what you're doing is you're drastically increasing the amount of water pressure that that soil or rock or whatever is going to see. So basically, if you've got enough water pressure and the soil or ground rock or whatever it is that you're building the dam on top of is soft and porous enough, what can actually happen is that the water pressure will force water underneath the dam and then through the ground, basically, and then out the other side.
Oh, like it finds its own way?
It finds its own way, right? And that's not actually always a bad thing. Like, sometimes that just happens because everything is permeable to a certain extent. So, like, sometimes it's not a big deal. But the danger with that, there is a real danger with that. And the danger with that is that that movement of water can carry particulate. And so if the ground is permeable enough and soft enough, it actually can eat away underneath the dam.
Oh, so you pretty much are making like a hydro sandblaster naturally. Well, exactly. I guess artificially, but
it's exactly. Going to cut away. It can actually erode away basically underneath the dam, right?
That's like the most important part.
It is. It is very important. So that's the danger here, right? But the results convinced him that the hill would make a satisfactory abutment for the dam, should the need ever arise. So that happened well before the construction of the dam. So then, so that all happens in like 1911. Yeah, so the population is increasing rapidly, and they planned the reservoir to be originally in a different canyon called Big Tajunga Canyon.
Where are they getting these names?
I don't know. It's California, man. I try not to ask too many questions.
Baja California.
So basically, because the Tajunga Canyon was basically, it would basically flood a whole bunch of private land, which was going to be really expensive to buy. They were like, what if we didn't do that? And what if we used basically the federally owned Francisquito Canyon and the area that would flood?
Makes sense.
And so that basically overrode that kind of cost, was part of the reason they overrode kind of that geological potential issues with the San Francisquito Canyon site. That's what happened there.
So we got a location change right off the rip.
Yeah. So initially there's a location change, which is good. But then, so they start designing the dam, and the initial design is, again, nearly identical to another dam that he built, the Mulholland Dam, which is located also in the San Francisco area, or Los Angeles area, excuse me. And I believe is still in use today. And it creates the Hollywood Reservoir.
Oh, outstanding. So yep. 100 years of service, just about?
Almost. So it opened in 1924. Yeah, so it is 100 years old this year.
Right on. That's good construction right there.
Absolutely. And so they build this dam, and that design, basically the Mulholland Dam, has water at a maximum of 183 feet depth, and stores almost 10 million cubic meters of water.
Wow.
Which is a lot.
That's a lot of water.
A lot of water. So, but back to the task at hand. The St. Francis Dam originally was designed like it's just going to be a duplicate. It's going to be the same.
Copy-paste.
And they did adjust it for different site parameters and stuff like this. But what ends up happening is basically during the construction of the dam, they're like, San Francisco is still growing, which means we need to store more water. So, Derek, what are you going to do if you need to store more water?
Well,
with your dam,
logic would say make it a touch bigger.
You're right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what they do. So they make the dam 10 feet taller.
Wait, they didn't change anything about the base?
No.
Wow, okay, that surely won't come back to haunt us later. Go on.
All right, Derek, I want you to explain why is that a problem?
Well, I am no engineer, as previously stated multiple times and shown by my stupidity at engineering. But if you're going to make something taller, you're putting more weight on it, right? And dams are really, as far as I know, pretty specifically engineered to the dimensions they are, because you're not just thinking about the dam. You're not even just thinking about the highest capacity of the water that it's going to be. You got to think about the flux, like up and down over multiple seasons. That's a lot of pressure differentials that are changing. If you make it taller without making it wider, it's just going to, like, think about a Lego block. It'll just tip over.
So you're exactly right, Derek. So basically the way that water pressure works is water pressure is directly correlated to the height of the water column. And fluid pressure in general is basically a function of the height of the water column, or the fluid column. And so the taller that your fluid column, i.e. the deeper the maximum depth of the dam is, the maximum depth of the water, the more pressure that you're going to have pushing that dam outward at the bottom of the dam.
Right.
Which, as we stated previously, is problematic because you have just more force pushing on the dam, which could cause it to tip over. But it also means you have more water pressure trying to push underneath the dam and get underneath the foundation of the dam.
Oh.
So it's a two-phase, like it's a two-part issue.
So you're like Sandy Loam blasting the bottom of your dam.
Exactly. I believe it's what's called scouring is what the term is.
Whoever it's made the concrete like failure names needs an award. Spalling. What did you just say?
Well, scouring is specifically where, like, the water flow is eating away at the foundation, like not the foundation itself, but like the soil around the foundation.
Okay. So the support structure of the structure.
Yeah.
That'd be hard to measure, wouldn't it?
It is. And scouring is a relatively difficult problem to deal with because it's very hard to predict. But yeah. But there are ways you can mitigate it. But anyway. Yeah, but so basically they initially are like, okay, well, the dam needs to be 10 feet higher. And then later they decide, okay, wait, this needs to be 10 foot higher again.
Oh, so they double down.
They double down. And so they basically, and this is like as the construction of the dam has begun, right? So like March 20, 1925, basically, the construction of the dam is supposed to start in August, basically. And in March of 1925, they raise the height again. So it's very tight window of like, hey, this has got to happen like real fast.
So are we still in the design phase, or are they actually pouring at this point?
No, they're like pouring concrete. I mean, like, oh, they're getting ready to pour concrete. Yeah, like.
So there's like no chance to go already back to the drawing board as far as this base problem that we both are thinking about. It seems.
Yeah.
Oh no! You know, just slap a little more on top of it. You know,
just put a little bit more on top of it. It'll be fine. Slap some more. And then, in addition to that, the second 10-foot increase basically requires that they make a dike along the top of the ridge of the western embankment in order to contain the reservoir, right?
Right.
Because basically, now what they've done is they've actually built the dam higher than the hills that they're building it around, just in that small localized area. So they have to build an extension, basically.
Just add in more hill.
They're just add more hill, right?
Simple.
Crucially, though, remember that that western hill is that red conglomerate.
Right.
So basically, they complete this dam or whatever, and they finish it in 1926, and they begin to fill the reservoir. Now, at this point in time, they did not have a great understanding of thermal expansion and contraction. So there were no expansion joints in the concrete structure of the dam.
Oh, we talking cyclic again? Cyclic loading?
We talking about thermal loading and concrete, right? So concrete actually does shrink a little bit as it cures. So it's usually important to put in basically areas for that shrinkage to happen in a controlled manner.
Hey, leave the dam alone. Maybe it's just a little cold.
Well, I didn't know about that at this time. But also, yeah, the heating and cooling is also important to have those expansion joints. The water rises uneventfully, but several temperature and contraction cracks appear in the dam, and a minor amount of seepage begins to flow under the abutments almost immediately. And because, again, there's no contraction joints that were incorporated in this dam, the two most notable cracks were vertical cracks that ran down through the dam from the top, one approximately 60 feet west of the outlet gates, and another about the same distance to the east. So they already have these kind of like in the center of the dam, these two parallel cracks that are starting to run down it. Right?
I'm no civil engineer, but I'm going to go chalk that under not good.
That's not great. So I would not be inspired of confidence.
You're about to have three dams.
Cracks are a legitimate thing that happens in concrete structures. I mean, it is part of it. The challenge, right, is this crack structural or is it superficial? And they inspect the cracks. Mulholland and his chief engineers and managers, Harvey Norman, inspect the cracks. They judge them to be expected because of the size of the dam. Basically, it's expected that you're going to have some cracking. It's going to be okay.
Okay.
So then the water keeps filling. By April of 1927, it was within 10 feet of the spillway. So like the water had raised pretty much all the way up.
Oh, wow.
And during most of May of 1927, the water level is still really high. It's within 3 feet of the top of the dam. I mean,
That's good, right?
It's good. Yeah. I mean, like you would expect it to be doing quite well. And it's not uncommon for dams to seep a little bit, right? Like we stated that the dam keeper, right? Like the guy who's responsible for maintenance upkeep of the dam.
Is that his real title? Name is,
it is, yeah, dam keeper. Nice. His name is Tony. This is another great one. Harnischfeger.
Tony Harnischfeger?
I believe. I think that's pronounced. I hope that I'm pronouncing that right.
Okay. Man, I hope Tony didn't have to go to middle school in the 20s because holy, I would have eaten that one up.
That would have been pretty bad. So basically, they take the seepage from the dam, funnel it into a 2-inch like pipe,
okay,
and then basically they lay it down the canyon to the dam keeper's house where he uses it for like domestic water.
Oh, so he gets a little like offset
for his. Yeah, he's just like, this is my garden hose, basically.
A little natural spring. Eight.
Yeah, which is kind of fun.
Well, a natural spring.
But the seepage is like very consistent, which is what you want to see, right? Okay. So like the consistent seepage is good because that means that the dam is at steady state, basically. Like there's no change happening.
The problem is when it starts going faster or slower unexpectedly.
Yes. Yes. So if you see like that surging, that basically is indicative of material is blocking and then unblocking the flow of that water. And that if you're losing material, basically if material is being moved by that seepage, that's problem. That's bad. But basically, they say that the St. Francis Dam was extremely dry, one of the driest structures they'd ever seen at the time. And the data for the dam actually shows that. In 1926, 1927, the dam was exceptionally dry.
Okay. No red flags yet.
So there's a problem with the Los Angeles Aqueduct at this time, because in May 27th of 1927... Do you know what's happening in California?
1927? I can't place it.
The California water wars are happening.
There was a water war?
There is a water war. And so basically, it's a conflict over water rights between the city of Los Angeles and California farmers and ranchers. Right, because this aqueduct that was built, right, it's traveling 233 miles.
It's a lot of a lot of platform.
Yeah. And so basically, like that's a lot of, yeah. And also it's a lot of water that's being drawn, right? And basically what that means is that people who were living in that valley, in the Owens River Valley, you know, they were trying to use that water too. And so they got really upset when basically the Los Angeles... You know, these city people, these upstarts who really just arrived, suddenly start taking a whole lot of water from, you know, basically a river valley 230 miles away. And then basically all these people who live in that valley, in the Owens Valley, are like, yo, what happened? Like, what gives? This is ridiculous. So people get really mad about this. And, it comes to violence. I mean, the Los Angeles aqueduct is actually, like, bombed a couple times. Yeah. That actually, one of the things that happens is in May of 1927, they bomb the aqueduct. And, basically what that means is that, you know, they have to stop the flow of water from that aqueduct, and now they're starting to draw it out of the St. Francis Dam.
Man, domestic terrorism over water rights sounds like an omen to future times, not a past one.
Like, that's the thing, is like, we're like, we are going to die in the resource wars, but like, we already have precedent.
Yeah, we already got the game plan. Farmers.
Like, we know how this is going to go.
So like, it's hard to feel bad about that, though, because it, like, it's their land. Like, they were there first.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if I'm not mistaken, modern history, we have a similar situation happening in, like, Las Vegas right now, because, you know, what happens when you build a super city in the desert, you got to pipe water into it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, like, you're absolutely right. Like, and water rights is a very complex issue, right? Because, obviously, like, we all need it to survive. And the question then becomes, like, how do you fairly distribute that?
Yeah. Right? How do you prioritize, like, lifeline water versus corporate / industrial manifesting? Like,
yeah. And, like, a lot of, you know, like, Las Vegas, which is, you know, it draws a lot of water.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of that really is ornamental, you know, yeah. Because of it's Las
Golf
Vegas.
Golf courses, you know, all that absolutely. Concrete strip. It's beautiful, don't get me wrong. Hell of a tourist destination, but why are we growing saffron there? You know, like, yeah. Grow it somewhere where there's already water, right?
There's obviously a lot of discussion nowadays, like, how do you fairly distribute that water? Because the people downstream still need water, too. I mean, like, you know, the Colorado River, which I believe is if I'm not mistaken, is the river that feeds Lake Mead. It is, I mean, it provides substantial amounts of water to Texas and Mexico as well, right? So, like, how do you balance the water rights and the needs of the people downstream with the needs of the people upstream, right? And where is that line? And that is a conversation that was being dealt with today, obviously, but also in 1927. But anyway, so basically, you know, they draw a lot of water out of it. The water level drops quite a bit. They repair the Los Angeles aqueduct, and water begins to fill the reservoir again. And the water level rises very steadily until February 28, when it was really pretty much topped out. So it was at the within 1 foot of the spillway, which is to say basically full, completely full. And during this time, they noticed several new cracks that began forming, specifically in the wing dike, which is that 10-foot section they had to build on the hilltop, basically to lengthen the hill because they raised it up an additional 20 feet. And so they noticed these new cracks, and that's always... yeah, that's always a cause a little bit for concern.
Yeah, I'd be a little stressed if I was the engineer doing the inspection. It's just like, year two, no crack. Oh, same two cracks that we're used to. Those weren't there last week, you know?
Yep. Yep, absolutely. And then in near the end of February, they discover a notable leak at the base of that dike, approximately 150 feet west of the dam, which sounds like a lot. It's far away. But that should be cause a little bit for concern. So again, Mulholland inspects it, judges it to be another contraction or temperature crack, And they basically say, okay, we're going to let it, you know, like we're basically going to put a pipe in it so that we can control that flow of water coming out. So okay. It's not scouring the dirt on the other side of the road.
So they're trying to just control where the water flows out?
Yes. Which sometimes is like all you can do. Because okay. Water has a tendency to just do whatever
it wants. It goes to the lowest common place. It's going to find it.
It's going to find it. But noticeably also in late 1927, another fracture is noticed that basically begins at the western abutment, the western hill, and it travels diagonally and upwards towards the center section. And then there's another one that appears in basically the same position, but on the other side that is basically doing the same thing. So now you have, to date, we have these four noticeable cracks, right? There's two kind of going up in the centers, and then there's two kind of coming diagonally in towards the top.
Do they connect?
They don't connect yet.
Okay.
And the, as far as we know, they never, well, as far as we are aware, they don't connect. But oh. There's, I'll show you, I'll send you a picture here in a little bit. It'll make things, I think, kind of clear. But again, they inspect the fractures, judge it to be contraction, and they order it to be filled with okrum and grout to seal off any leakage, basically to stabilize it. So then, that brings us to March of 1928, March 7th, 1928. The water reservoir, the reservoir is 3 inches below the spillway.
It's a little close.
Mulholland is very close to full. Very, very, very full. Mulholland orders no more water be pushed into the St. Francis Dam, by which that basically means you're opening the floodgates to allow all of the water that's coming in to also be let out.
Oh, so just you have a net.
The dam is full.
Net zero.
So you have a net zero, exactly. So then, a couple weeks go by. 5 days later. 5 days later, while conducting his morning rounds, what was his name? Tony Harnischfeger. Jesus,
that's a tough one.
Yeah. So he is conducting his like normal inspections of the dam, finds a new leak on the west abutment, and this is concerning, not only because it is where other leaks have been found, but also because the color of the water is muddy.
Oh, that means it's bringing stuff.
That means it's bringing stuff. So they go back and they immediately they alert Mulholland, and they go and they begin inspecting the area. They follow the source, they follow the runoff, and they determine that the muddy appearance of the water was not from the leak itself, but it came from where the water contacted loose soil from a newly cut access road. So then they're going back through it, and they say, okay, well, it's fine. We need to correct this, but it's not going to, you know, we're not in danger of imminent collapse. So then a few more days later, right, so as they're watching, they're observing this leak over the course of a couple of hours. But the location, the concern was heightened because of the location, but also because the flow of the discharge was not consistent. You have this surging that is happening. So they feel like that they do need to perform some corrective measures, but they think that they have some time. They think that they have some time.
Oh, Jim, they always but do.
They always think that you do. So 2.5 minutes before midnight. Let me set another stage for you real quick. Let me set you the stage. You're a guy. You're a guy. There you go. So they think that the collapse occurred very, very quickly. There's no surviving eyewitnesses to the collapse. But the collapse occurs basically about 2.5 minutes before midnight is what they think. And basically, let me kind of set the stage. You're a guy. Your name is Ace Hopewell. You're a carpenter for Powerhouse Number One.
Okay.
And you're on your motorcycle. It's a beautiful evening.
Sick. I'm so cool.
You're so cool. It's a beautiful evening. You're on your motorcycle, you know, on the canyon roads
of
San Francisco Canyon. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to stop for a cigarette. So you you pass by the dam, you see it, everything looks fine. You pass by the dam, you go up a mile and a half. You hear this rumbling sound, like rocks rolling down the hill, which is not uncommon. Like landslides and stuff are not uncommon in this area. So you pull over and you smoke a cigarette while you check the hillsides to make sure you're not about to motorcycle into like a bunch of rocks.
Right. Okay. Reasonable.
Reasonable. You finish your cigarette, you drop it on the ground and like grind it into the ground with your heel.
Or I'm so cool.
You're so cool. Put on your shades at midnight.
Oh, yeah. And then
your leather jacket, and then ride your motorcycle off into the sunset at midnight. And you would be the last person to see the St. Francis Dam alive, intact.
Wow.
Because that rumble that you heard on your motorcycle that you thought was a rock slide was actually the dam collapsing.
So if he had gone past that bridge, just like if he had his cigarette before, you know, like at the dam, he would have been
gone. He probably would have died.
Oh, this dude's so cool.
And so basically like the first notice that anybody has of this is basically the power and light receiving stations in Los Angeles. Basically, they both see this really sharp voltage drop.
Oh.
At 11:57 p.m., basically the voltages drop and a transformer at the South California Edison substation explodes, right? And they're like, so obviously something has happened because these dams are also used for hydroelectric power. And so basically that's what they're using to time the collapse of the dam. Is because basically immediately you have this 180 foot tall wave of water that's going down the mountain.
Right.
Very, very, very fast. Pretty much immediately destroys the power substations that are generating power from the dam, right?
Oh, so that's where the voltage loss is. It's not them creating power less. It's the whole substation got wiped.
And so basically the substation gets wiped. And the dam itself basically breaks into several pieces. And like a good chunk of the dam, like a huge chunk of the dam, I'll send you a picture here in a minute, is washed like half a mile down canyon by this wave of water.
Sheesh.
To give you an idea, the Harnischfeger family was probably like the first people who were killed. And they actually found the body of a woman who was living with that family, fully clothed, basically wedged between two blocks of concrete near the base of the dam. So what they think is that she and Harnischfeger were inspecting the structure immediately before its failure.
Oh, they were near it or on it?
That's what they think.
Wow.
Because they never find Harnischfeger's body is never found.
Wow.
Yeah. But they think that they basically were inspecting the dam when it catastrophically.
There's no worse place to be. Like, that's the scariest death, probably, because you kind of hear and see it coming instantly and then nothing.
And there's nothing you can do about
yeah.
it.
Yeah. There's no getting away.
Like you see the one side of the dam probably collapsing and then it's over.
Yeah. It's like, oh, that's weird. Oh, and I'm gone. Just like that.
Yep. And then, so 5 minutes after the collapse, the flood wave is now 120 feet high.
You're kidding me.
And has traveled 1.5 miles.
It's accelerating, isn't it?
It shouldn't be, but it's okay. But its average speed of 18 miles an hour is still pretty fast.
Think about like a tsunami as an equivalent. 128 foot surge is deadly.
That's big.
Anybody.
That's real big.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it destroys, as I said, it destroys powerhouse number two. And it kills 64 of the workers who lived there. And their families who live nearby. So power to Los Angeles is immediately cut, basically, also. And then as the floodwaters continue down the riverbed, It basically just goes and it destroys everything in its path. So at 1 a.m., at this point, the wave of water is still 55 feet high and demolishes another power substation, the Saugus substation, which is one of the substations that initially measured that initial power loss, basically, because it's just another power station that's further downstream.
You got to think about the apocalyptic view of whoever's in the control panel of, like, the overall. Like, you're just seeing, oh, this is substation 2's light off. Oh, that one's off. What's happening? Why are they all going off? That would be horrifying.
That would be terrifying. Yeah, that would be really, really, really scary.
Like, you know something's wrong, but you have no contact. Like, this is before cameras. Like, we don't have surveillance cameras. You just have, like, meters and valves and gauges.
Yeah. So then the flood enters the Santa Clarita River Valley, still moving at 12 miles an hour.
Jeez.
But basically, a temporary construction camp had been set up downstream for another, basically, power station. And they're basically, there's 150 men who were basically camped there. And because this is all happening so fast in the confusion, nobody's issued a warning. 84 of these guys die.
Wait, there's no, like, flood alarms or anything back then?
There's no flood alarms. There's no warning systems.
Oh, wow. So this is before, because, like, we've talked about the TVA briefly in one episode. Like, that's one thing, if you're lucky enough, you'd be passing over a dam, they'll do a test of, like, the alert system. They'll give you, like, a text to everyone to make sure that they know it's not real. But
right.
It's just interesting that to think of a time before, when you say no warning, you mean it. Like, you're there one moment, gone the next.
Yeah. And so, excuse me. The first recorded, like, phone call that we have basically getting the word out is basically at 1:30 a.m. So an hour and a half after the dam has collapsed, the Pacific Long Distance Telephone Company tells a Santa Clara River Valley telephone operator that the dam has failed. So she calls a motorcycle officer with the Motor State Division, like a police officer, and then begins calling, like, homes that are in the floodplain.
Right.
Basically.
Try to see if you can make contact, get a status update or something.
Absolutely. So then, like, the officer is going door to door warning residents. A deputy sheriff is now screaming up the valley, siren blaring, until he has to, like, stop because he's met the floodwaters, basically.
Okay, so he met the point of the wall, so to speak.
Pretty much. And basically the flood really pretty much destroys the towns of Fillmore, Bardsdale, and Santa Paula.
Wait, it's taking out whole towns?
Yeah.
Holy
man. There's a lot of water.
It's a lot of people.
And a lot of people. Absolutely. And eventually it finally reaches the Pacific Ocean, 54 miles downstream of, Ventura, at basically 5:30 a.m. At which point the wave was almost 2 miles wide and still traveling 6 miles per hour.
Like, 6 miles per hour, I know in our day and age, that's not a lot, right? Like, I feel, you could probably outrun that, but really, no, there's nowhere to go.
Because you've got to run 6 miles an hour for 54 miles.
Like diagonally, like, to get away from it.
Yeah, to get out of the way from it. Like, I mean, there's just no way. I mean, like,
and
you're
in a valley. Like, you either climb or submit. At that point,
pretty much.
This is giving me new things to be afraid of. Holy.
I'm going to send you a couple of pictures. So they end up, like, getting back to the dam. And there's basically what's called the tombstone, basically. And so the west abutment is pretty much completely destroyed. And then the eastern side is also swept away, but the center section is left upright.
Oh wait, that's the dam, or what's left of it? I didn't realize I was looking at a before and after.
Mm-hmm. And so, like, this is not supported by any of the reports that I've read, but my suspicion is that basically those two cracks that we talked about, very initial cracks that kind of went straight up ones? And down, the vertical ones that were either side of the center section of the dam, which coincidentally is the section that's still there in that picture that I showed you. My suspicion is that those two cracks are basically what allowed that center section to remain.
Wow. Right? So the cracks,
basically
what they thought was just a cosmetic thing ended up being more serious, or is that, was the read correct on that assessment?
The read, I think, was correct on that. So they do an investigation actually like really quickly. And basically what they find is that this reddish conglomerate that they had talked about so much previously, when it was wet, became so soft that it really was not worth anything. And basically what had happened is when they think that the west end fails first, right? The water had undermined that part of the dam, right? So that was scouring it. So then once you have that initial failure on the dike, that water now has a place to come through. And as that water is coming through really rapidly, it's scouring and pulling more and more material. And so it can create a very fast chain reaction, basically. And so it's like a zipper almost, where it basically just that water is zip, basically down the side of the hillside and then rips that side of the dam off, basically.
That's an extreme amount of force. Like if you're just thinking about, like looking at the picture there, I can't visualize, you know, 100,000 cubic meters of water or whatever, but looking at it and imagining that barreling towards your house, it's doomsday scenario. Like there is nothing you could do.
It is.
It's almost biblical.
It is. I mean, the pure elemental, the pure elemental destruction is mind-boggling. I mean, really, because you just don't think about it very much. But anyway, so what they end up coming to the conclusion is basically that the real failure point of the dam was the substrate upon which it was built, which I think is supported by the fact that the Mulholland Dam is still standing and in good service to this day.
So same dam type, minus the 20-foot additions. Different foundation.
Yep. And it's interesting too. So one of the political backdrops to this is that the Hoover Dam, which is basically the same type of construction, it's a gravity arch dam.
Just massive.
Concrete, it's just bigger. Yeah, basically. So that was kind of on the line, right? Because this failure happened like while the bill was in Congress.
That's gonna affect public opinion.
So one of the reasons like these investigations happened like really fast was they were like, we're on a time crunch to make sure that we basically get to the bottom of this so that we can move forward, because the Hoover Dam was like a huge infrastructure project, right?
One of the biggest of all time.
Yeah, one of the largest, certainly in the United States history. So that's kind of what they end up coming up with.
You're talking about this mystical situation where Congress is passing bills. Is that was that like a original Congress thing, or do we still do that?
No, we don't do that anymore.
We don't do that.
It's kind of fallen. We don't do that here anymore. It's kind of fallen out of fashion. But so that's the theory. Now, one of the other theories that come out with kind of later is that the eastern side of the embankment is actually also compromised. And that's why the eastern side of the dam also fails, is really because the eastern side of the embankment is basically not actually all rock. It's basically, there was a landslide that carried rock from below the grade, as it were, onto the eastern embankment. And that kind of creates this false illusion of there being solid rock there.
But it's not the same as the bedrock.
But it's not actually, exactly. So it's underneath that rock layer, there's more of this red conglomerate that's also contributing to the leaking.
Dude, all my friends hate Red Conglomerate. What's that?
Exactly.
Dude, right? I didn't expect, like, they were so meticulous about, you know, inspecting the bed before they started building it and, like, trying to make sure they did their due diligence, and it still wasn't enough.
Yeah.
It's not like they just said, oh, screw it, we'll just ignore it. They actually, like, made modifications to account for it, and it still failed like this.
Yeah, it's tough. And I will say, like, again, like, this is, obviously, this is still in the infancy of, like, understanding geological, like, structure and like, foundation stuff like this. You know, we have a lot more sophisticated ways to look at this now, but it's kind of, it is wild. I mean, it's crazy, so.
Yeah, I guess you couldn't just do a, like, seismograph of the ground below back then.
Not in that time. But, yeah, like, so the, yeah, it's kind of crazy because, like, just the standing tombstone, is what it was called. The tombstone is its center section of the dam that's still upright.
Eerie and well named.
Just destroyed.
You said, yes, 400 dead, three separate towns. And it's not like these towns are next to each other like what we'd expect today. This isn't like suburb.
They're spaced out.
They're miles, hundreds of miles apart at some places.
Nah, not quite hundreds, well, but
tens, like
miles.
50s.
I mean, they're tens of miles apart.
Right? That's a crazy amount of distance for water to travel that quickly. I mean, it's just something that's hard to imagine unless you lived through something like that.
Absolutely. I mean, and it really, I mean, again, it just really, to me, is like it's a cautionary tale of, like, you know, you are messing with powers beyond your mind, right? Like, beyond your comprehension when you kind of do this kind of stuff.
Seriously. And things can just change. So the conditions can change so unexpectedly. I think that's what makes it so dangerous in these times.
Absolutely.
You have no x-ray to look at a certain interior cross-section of the dam. Once it's built, it's built. All you can do is expect the exterior, right?
That's absolutely right. And and our ability to inspect structures has greatly increased as well, obviously, since then. Ultrasonic was
shout out to the boys at FLIR.
But anyway, so that's this episode, Derek. I think I'm done.
No, Jim, I appreciate you struggling through it. This one,
we marshaled through it. We did a good get this out for our beautiful listeners.
Like, all of our, like, fans that have listened to multiple episodes up to this point can tell, like, Jim, your voice does not sound like you're 100%, man.
We're fading. We're fading towards the end here.
Gosh. Well, as an engineer, any last notes? Like, there's a lot of lessons learned. I'm sure that there was some legislation that came out of this, at least as far, and maybe not legislation, but the regulation standards for bedrock and inspecting the pre-built area.
I think you're probably correct. I honestly didn't have time to kind of go into that this much on this one.
No, it's just, engineering is such a multifaceted, I love this podcast because I get to learn about it the same way that the listeners are. It's not like I get the script before. And I'm just thinking, how many dams have we driven over? You know, just living in Georgia, we don't even have that many waterways, all things considered, but there's a lot of dams in North Georgia. And the fact that something like this, I guess it builds the reason of why there's so many safeguards that you could see looking at a dam. Even if you look at the shittiest TVA dam that we have today under maintenance, there's, you know, regular sirens, like, you know, downstream warning systems that have been tested usually monthly, like the emergency alert system in the States. Because it's so critical, that 15 minutes of get your family, get in the car and drive south might just be the thing that saves, you know?
Absolutely. Because, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's like the water is traveling 18 miles an hour initially.
Right.
And, like, that is not insignificant, but it's also not inescapable if you're in a vehicle.
Right.
If you have some warning, if you have a little bit of lead time.
And you have an organized escape route. That's the key. You get a traffic jam, it's over.
If there's a plan, if there's a good plan in place and there's good warning signs, there's at least the ability to mitigate the loss of life, right? None of that was in place because it was the 1920s.
I just want to call back to our motorcycle guy real quick before we stop. Coolest character, but also the luckiest guy. He had time to drive across the dam, stop, have a cig, put it out, enjoy, I assume, take in, bask in the glory of nature, and then just, like, you know, riding home.
Yep.
A casual
completely
sound.
Completely oblivious.
What does that man think the rest of his life? He's heard this thing that he, in hindsight, knows was the dam failing, knowing he was moments away.
Yeah, dude. It's like one of those times where you like chills down your spine.
Oh,
it's
my
like,
goodness.
Could have been me.
Play the lottery.
Could have been me. Yeah, dude.
Sweet goodness.
Go home and kiss your loved ones.
Yeah, hug your kids. You know, it probably didn't even hit him. Like, it's just one of those. It was such a casual moment in his life. I'm guessing it came up since he was able to interview for, or at least put out the statement in the paper or whatever.
Yeah, he testifies at there's basically an inquest type thing. Where they try to collect some data, and he testifies at that.
Well, folks, on that note, I can't let Jim's voice suffer any longer. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Everything's a Spring. Jim, got anything to plug?
Check us out on all of our social medias. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook, maybe.
I don't think we're on Facebook.
Okay, fair enough. Probably not worth being on.
We'll call it Instagram, Facebook. They own it.
Meta. On Instagram. We're on Meta.
Come on now.
Whatever.
That's where all I put the spicy bits on the Instagram.
Oh, the spicy bits are on our Instagram. Check out our Instagram for the spicy bits. If you want to see some images and stuff, check out our YouTube feed. We post that there as well, so we can include pictures and stuff of all the things we're talking about. But yeah, check us out. Leave us a comment. If you enjoyed today's podcast, it would be awesome if you would leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcast. That helps the show out tremendously to get our network larger and our reach further. But thank you so much for listening. It means the world to me and Derek.
I got one last thing to
enjoy this. All right, what you got?
I put a poll out on the last episode, right? So as you know, me and Jim are going to Hawaii soon. And as I keep seeing on our aircraft types for our reservation gets changed because apparently some Boeing 737 MAX 9s may have had a door bolt failure, which we should definitely talk about. And
oh, that would be a great episode for Hawaii.
Right? We were on that plane. That was the plane that was scheduled to take us. And they changed it, obviously, or like they grounded them for a while. So I have a poll that says, who would win in survival in the case that our plane goes down? It's me versus Jim survival style. Who lives the longest? Who would win the show Survivor? Go to our last episode on Spotify. Answer the poll. I'm interested to see what you think.
That's exciting. I'm interested to see. All right. Well, Derek, I think that's about all I've got for tonight. So let's bounce.
Let's bounce.